acquired movements and habits to disguise what to him was a burning defect. He sat with his left ankle on his right knee, never the other way around. And he danced each new dance with a curious, stiff-legged step that the girls loved and other boys eventually copied. The deformity was mostly in his mind. Mostly, but not completely, for he did have shooting pains in that leg after several hours on a basketball court. He favored it, believed it was polio, and felt secretly connected to the late President Roosevelt for that reason. Even when everybody was raving about Truman because he had set up a committee on civil rights, Milkman secretly preferred FDR and felt very close to him. Closer, in fact, to him than to his own father, for Macon had no imperfection, and age seemed to strengthen him. Milkman feared his father, respected him, but knew, because of the leg, that he could never emulate him. So he differed from him as much as he dared. Macon was clean-shaven. Milkman was desperate for a mustache. Macon wore bow ties. Milkman wore four-in-hands. Macon didn't part his hair. Milkman had a part shaved into his. Macon hated tobacco. Milkman tried to put a cigarette in his mouth every 15 minutes. Macon hoarded his money. Milkman gave his away. But he couldn't help sharing with Macon his love of good shoes and fine, thin socks. And he did try, as his father's employee, to do the work the way Macon wanted it done. Macon was delighted. His son belonged to him now, and not to Ruth. And he was relieved at not having to walk all over town like a peddler collecting rents. It made his business more dignified, and he had time to think, to plan, to visit the bankmen, to read the public notices, auctions, to find out what plots were going for taxes, unclaimed heirs' property, where roads were being built, what supermarkets, schools, and who was trying to sell what to the government for the housing projects that were going to be built, the quickie townlets that were springing up around war plants. He knew as a Negro he wasn't going to get a big slice of the pie, but there were properties nobody wanted yet, or little edges of property somebody didn't want Jews to have, or Catholics to have, or properties nobody knew were of any value yet. There was quite a bit of pie filling oozing around the edges of the crust in 1945. Filling that could be his. Everything had improved for Macon dead during the war. Except Ruth. And years later, when the war was over and that pie filling had spilled over into his very lap, had stickied his hands and weighed his stomach down into a sagging paunch, he still wished he had strangled her back in 1921. She hadn't stopped spending occasional nights out of the house, but she was 50 years old now, and what lover could she have kept so long? What lover could there be that even Freddie didn't know about? Macon decided it was of no importance, and less often did he get angry enough to slap her, particularly after the final time, which became final because his son jumped up and knocked him back into the radiator. Milkman was 22 then, and since he had been fucking for 6 years, some of them with the same woman, he'd begun to see his mother in a new light. She was no longer the person who worried him about galoshes and colds and food, who stood in the way of most of the little pleasures he could take at home because they all involved some form of dirt, noise, or disarray. Now he saw her as a frail woman, content to do tiny things, to grow and cultivate small life that would not hurt her if it died. Rhododendron, goldfish, dahlias, geraniums, imperial tulips, because these little lives did die. The goldfish floated to the top of the water, and when she tapped the side of the bowl with her fingernail, they did not flash away in a lightning arc of terror. The rhododendron leaves grew wide and green, and when their color was at its deepest and waxiest, they suddenly surrendered it and lapsed into limp yellow hearts. In a way, she was jealous of death. Inside all that grief she felt when the doctor died, there had been a bit of pique, too, as though he had chosen a more interesting subject than life, a more provocative companion than she was, and had deliberately followed death when it beckoned. She was fierce in the presence of death, heroic even, as she was at no other time. Its threat gave her direction, clarity, audacity. Regardless of what Macon had done, she'd always suspected that the doctor didn't have to die if he hadn't wanted to. And it may have been that suspicion of personal failure and rejection, plus a smidgen of revenge against Macon, that made her lead her husband down paths from which there was no exit, save violence. Lena thought Macon's rages unaccountable, but Corinthians began to see a plan, to see how her mother had learned to bring her husband to a point, not of power. A 9-year-old girl could slap Ruth and get away with it, but of helplessness. She would begin by describing some incident in which she was a sort of honest buffoon. It began as a piece of pleasant dinner conversation, harmless on the surface, because no one at the table was required to share her embarrassment. But all were able to admire her honesty and to laugh at her ignorance. She had gone to the wedding of Mrs. Dvorak's granddaughter. Anna Dvorak was an old Hungarian woman who had been one of her father's patients. He had many working-class white patients and some middle-class white women who thought he was handsome. Anna Dvorak was convinced that the doctor had miraculously saved her son's life by not sending him to the tuberculosis sanatorium back in 1903. Almost everybody who did go to the SAN, as they called it, died in it. Anna didn't know that the doctor had no practicing privileges there, just as he had done at Mercy. Nor did she know that the cure for tuberculosis in 1903 was precisely the one most detrimental to the patients. All she knew was that the doctor had prescribed a certain diet, hours of rest to be rigidly adhered to, and cod liver oil twice a day. The boy survived. It was natural that she would want the miracle doctor's daughter at the wedding of this son's youngest daughter. Ruth went, and when the congregation went to the altar to receive the host, she went also. Kneeling there, with her head bowed, she was not aware that the priest was left with the choice of placing the wafer on her hat or skipping her. He knew immediately that she was not Catholic, since she did not raise her head at his words and push out her tongue for the wafer to be carefully placed there. Corpus Domini, Nostri Jesu Christi, said the priest, and then, to her, a sharp whisper, "Sss, raise your head." She looked up, saw the wafer and the acolyte holding a little silver tray under it. Corpus Domini, Nostri Jesu Christi, custodiat animam tuam. The priest held the host toward her, and she opened her mouth. Later, at the reception, the priest asked her, point blank, whether she was Catholic. "No, I'm Methodist," she said. "I see," he said. "Well, the sacraments of the church are reserved for..." Just then, old Mrs. Dvorak interrupted him. "Father," she said, "I want you to meet one of my dearest friends, Dr. Foster's daughter. Her father saved Ricky's life. Ricky wouldn't be here today if..." Father Padre smiled and shook Ruth's hand. "Very pleased to meet you, Miss Foster." It was a simple occurrence, elaborately told. Lena listened and experienced each phrase of her mother's emotion, from religious ecstasy to innocent confidence to embarrassment. Corinthians listened analytically, expectantly, wondering how her mother would develop this anecdote into a situation in which Macon would either lash out at her verbally or hit her. Milkman was only half listening. "Are you Catholic?" he asked me. "Well, I was embarrassed for a minute, but then I said, 'No, I'm Methodist.' And he started to tell me that only Catholics could take communion in a Catholic church. Well, I never heard of that. Anybody can take communion, I thought. At our church, anybody could come up on the first Sunday. Well, before he could get it out, Anna came up and said, 'Father, I want you to meet one of my dearest friends, Dr. Foster's daughter.' Well, the priest was all smiles then and shook my hand and said he was so very pleased and honored to make my acquaintance. So it all turned out all right. But honestly, I didn't know. I went up there as innocent as a lamb. You didn't know that only Catholics take communion in a Catholic church?" Macon Dead asked her, his tone making it clear that he didn't believe her. "No, Macon, how would I know? You see them put up their own school, keep their kids out of public schools, and you still think their religious stuff is open to anybody who wants to drop in? Communion is communion, you silly woman." "Father Pedro didn't think so. You made a fool of yourself. Mrs. Dvorak didn't think so. She was just trying to keep the wedding going, keep you from fucking it up." "Macon, please don't use that language in front of the children." "What goddamn children? Everybody in here is old enough to vote." "There is no call for an argument. You make a fool of yourself in a Catholic church, embarrass everybody at the reception, and come to the table to gloat about how wonderful you were, Macon, and sit there, lying, saying you didn't know any better. Anna Dvorak wasn't the least bit. Anna Dvorak don't even know your name. She called you Dr. Foster's daughter. I bet you $100 she still don't know your name. You by yourself ain't nobody. You your daddy's daughter." "That's so," said Ruth, in a thin but steady voice. "I certainly am my daddy's daughter." She smiled. Macon didn't wait to put his fork down. He dropped it on the table while his hand was on its way across the bread plate, becoming the fist he smashed into her jaw. Milkman hadn't planned any of it, but he had to know that one day, after Macon hit her, he'd see his mother's hand cover her lips as she searched with her tongue for any broken teeth and, discovering none, tried to adjust the partial plate in her mouth without anyone noticing. And that on that day, he would not be able to stand it. Before his father could draw his hand back, Milkman had yanked him by the back of his coat collar, up out of his chair, and knocked him into the radiator. The window shade flapped and rolled itself up. "You touch her again one more time, and I'll kill you." Macon was so shocked at being assaulted, he could not speak. He had come to believe, after years of creating respect and fear wherever he put his foot down, after years of being the tallest man in every gathering, that he was impregnable. Now he crept along the wall, looking at a man who was as tall as he was, and 40 years younger. Just as the father brimmed with contradictory feelings as he crept along the wall, humiliation, anger, and a grudging feeling of pride in his son, so the son felt his own contradictions. There was the pain and shame of seeing his father crumple before any man, even himself. Sorrow in discovering that the pyramid was not a 5,000-year wonder of the civilized world, mysteriously and permanently constructed by generation after generation of hardy men who had died in order to perfect it, but that it had been made in the back room at Sears by a clever window dresser of paper mache, guaranteed to last for a mere lifetime. He also felt glee, a snorting, horse-galloping glee as old as desire. He had won something and lost something in the same instant. Infinite possibilities and enormous responsibilities stretched out before him. But he was not prepared to take advantage of the former or accept the burden of the latter. So he cock-walked around the table and asked his mother, "Are you all right?" She was looking at her fingernails. "Yes, I'm fine." Milkman looked at his sisters. He had never been able to really distinguish them or their roles from his mother. They were in their early teens when he was born. They were 35 and 36 now. But since Ruth was only 16 years older than Lena, all three had always looked the same age to him. Now, when he met his sister's eyes over the table, they returned him a look of hatred so fresh, so new, it startled him. Their pale eyes no longer appeared to blur into their even paler skin. It seemed to him as though charcoal lines had been drawn around their eyes, that two drag lines had been smudged down their cheeks, and their rosy lips were swollen in hatred, so full it was about to burst through. Milkman had to blink twice before their faces returned to the vaguely alarmed blandness he was accustomed to. Quickly, he left the room, realizing there was no one to thank him or abuse him. His action was his alone. It would change nothing between his parents. It would change nothing inside them. He had knocked his father down, and perhaps there were some new positions on the chessboard, but the game would go on. Sleeping with Hager had made him generous, or so he thought. Wide-spirited, or so he imagined. Wide-spirited and generous enough to defend his mother, whom he almost never thought about, and to deck his father, whom he both feared and loved. Back in his bedroom, Milkman fiddled with things on his dresser. There was a pair of silver-backed brushes his mother had given him when he was 16, engraved with his initials, the abbreviated degree designation of a doctor. He and his mother had joked about it, and she hinted strongly that he ought to consider going to medical school. He foisted her off with, "How would that look, M.D., M.D.? If you were sick, would you go see a man called Dr. Dead?" She laughed, but reminded him that his middle name was Foster. Couldn't he use Foster as a last name? Dr. Macon Foster. Didn't that sound fine? He had to admit that it did. The silver-backed brushes were a constant reminder of what her wishes for him were, that he not stop his education at high school, but go on to college and medical school. She had as little respect for her husband's work as Macon had for college graduates. To Milkman's father, college was time spent in idleness, far away from the business of life, which was learning to own things. He was eager for his daughters to go to college, where they could have found suitable husbands, and one, Corinthians, did go. But it was pointless for Milkman, particularly since his son's presence was a real help to him in the office. So much so that he had been able to get his bank friends to speak to some of their friends and get his son moved out of 1A draft classification and into necessary to support family status. Milkman stood before his mirror and glanced in the low light of the wall lamp at his reflection. He was, as usual, unimpressed with what he saw. He had a fine enough face, eyes women complimented him on, a firm jawline, splendid teeth. Taken apart, it looked all right, even better than all right. But it lacked coherence, a coming together of the features into a total self. It was all very tentative, the way he looked, like a man peeping around a corner of some place he's not supposed to be, trying to make up his mind whether to go forward or to turn back. The decision he made would be extremely important, but the way in which he made the decision would be careless, haphazard, and uninformed. Standing there in the lamplight, trying not to think of how his father had looked, creeping along the wall, he heard a knock at his door. He didn't want to see the face of Lena or Corinthians, nor to have any secret talk with his mother. But he was not any happier to see his father looming there in the hall. A line of blood was still visible in the thin cut at the corner of Macon's mouth. But he stood straight, and his eyes were steady. "Look, Daddy," Milkman began. "I don't say anything," Macon said, pushing past him. "Sit down." Milkman moved toward the bed. "Look here, let's try to forget this. If you promise, I told you to sit down. And down is what I mean." Macon's voice was low, but his face looked like Pilate's. He closed the door. "You're a big man now, but big ain't nearly enough. You have to be a whole man. And if you want to be a whole man, you have to deal with the whole truth. You don't have to do any of this, you know. I don't need to know everything between you and Mama. I do have to do it, and you do need to know it. If you're in the business of raising your fist at your father, you better have some intelligence behind that fist the next time you throw it. Nothing I'm about to say is by way of apology or excuse. It's just information. I married your mother in 1917. She was 16, living alone with her father. I can't tell you I was in love with her. People didn't require that as much as they do now. Folks were expected to be civilized to one another, honest, and clear. You relied on people being what they said they were, because there was no other way to survive. The important thing, when you took a wife, was that the two of you agreed on what was important. Your mother's father never liked me, and I have to say, I was very disappointed in him. He was just about the biggest Negro in this city. Not the richest, but the most respected. But a bigger hypocrite never lived. Kept all his money in 4 different banks. Always calm and dignified. I thought he was naturally that way. Until I found out he sniffed ether. Negroes in this town worshipped him. He didn't give a damn about them, though. Called them cannibals. He delivered both your sisters himself, and each time all he was interested in was the color of their skin. He would have disowned you. I didn't like the notion of his being his own daughter's doctor, especially since she was also my wife. Mercy wouldn't take colored then. Anyway, Ruth wouldn't go to any other doctor. I tried to get a midwife for her, but the doctor said midwives were dirty. I told him a midwife delivered me, and if a midwife was good enough for my mother, a midwife was good enough for his daughter. Well, we had some words between us about it, and I ended up telling him that nothing could be nastier than a father delivering his own daughter's baby. That stamped it. We had very little to say after that. But they did it anyway, both Lena and Corinthians. They let me do the naming by picking a word blind, but that was all. Your sisters are just a little over a year apart, you know? And both times, he was there. She had her legs wide open, and he was there. I know he was a doctor. And doctors not supposed to be bothered by things like that. But he was a man before he was a doctor. I knew then they ganged up on me forever, the both of them. And no matter what I did, they managed to have things their way. They made sure I remembered whose house I was in, where the china came from, how he sent to England for the Waterford bowl, and again for the table they put it on. That table was so big, they had to take it apart to get it in the door. He was always bragging about how he was the second man in the city to have a 2-horse carriage. Where I'd come from, the farm we had, that was nothing to them. And what I was trying to do, they didn't have any interest in that. Buying shacks in Shacktown, they called it. How's Shacktown? That's the way he'd greet me in the evenings. But it wasn't that. I could put up with that, because I knew what I wanted and pretty much how to get it. So I could put up with that. Did put up with it. It was something else. Something I couldn't put my finger on. I tried to get him to spend some of that money out of those 4 banks once. Some tract land was going for a lot of money, railroad money. Erie Lackawanna was buying. I had a good hunch where the track would be laid. I walked all around over there, the shore road, the docks, the fork in Route 6 and 2. I figured out just where the tracks would have to go and found land I could have got cheap and sold back to the railroad agents. He wouldn't lend me a dime. If he had, he would have died a rich man. Instead of a fairly middling one, and I would have been way ahead. I asked your mother to talk him into it. I told her exactly where the Erie was headed. She said it had to be his decision, she couldn't influence him. She told me, her husband, that. Then I began to wonder who she was married to, me or him. Well, he took sick. Macon stopped, as though the mention of illness reminded him of his own frailty, and pulled a large white handkerchief out of his pocket. Gingerly, he pressed it against the thin cut on his lip. He looked at the faint stain it made on his handkerchief. All that ether, he said, must have got in his blood. They had another name for it, but I know it was that ether. He just lay down and started swelling up. His body did. His legs and arms just wasted away. He couldn't see patients anymore. And for the first time in his life, the pompous donkey found out what it was like to have to be sick and pay another donkey to make you well. One of them doctors, the one that was taking care of him, one of the same ones, wouldn't let him set foot in their hospital, and who, if he had delivered their daughter's or wife's baby, had even thought of it, would have run him out of here on a rail. One of them, the ones he thought worth his attention, well, he came in here with some magic potion, Radiothor, and told him it would cure him. Ruth was all excited, and for a few days he was better. Then he got sicker, couldn't move. Holes were forming in his scalp, and he just lay there, in that bed where your mother still sleeps. And then he died there. Helpless, fat stomach, skinny arms and legs, looking like a white rat. He couldn't digest his food, you know. Had to drink all his meals and swallow something after every meal. I believe to this day that was ether, too. The night he died, I'd been over on the other side of town fixing a porch that fell down. Mr. Bradley's house. Porch had been leaning for 20 years, and then just fell down, split clean away from the foundation. I got some men to help me and went over there to get it back up so the people wouldn't have to jump to get out of the house and climb up 3 feet to get in it. Somebody tiptoed up to me and said, "Doctor died." "Ruth," they said, "was upstairs with him." I figured she was upset and went up right away to comfort her. I didn't have time to change clothes from working on the porch, but I went up anyway. She was sitting in a chair next to his bed, and the minute she saw me, she jumped up and screamed at me. "You dare come in here like that? Clean yourself. Clean up before you come in here." It vexed me some, but I do respect the dead. I went and washed up, took a bath, put on a clean shirt and collar, and went back in. Macon paused and touched his cut lip as though that were where the pain that showed in his eyes was coming from. "In the bed," he said, and stopped for so long, Milkman was not sure he was going to continue. "In the bed. That's where she was when I opened the door. Laying next to him, naked as a yard dog, kissing him. Him dead and white and puffy and skinny. And she had his fingers in her mouth." Now, I want you to know, I had a terrible time after that. I started thinking all sorts of things. If Lena and Corinthians were my children, I came to know pretty quick they were, 'cause it was clear that bastard couldn't fuck nothing. Ether took care of whatever he had in that area long before I got there. And he wouldn't have been so worried about what color skin they had unless they were coming from me. Then I thought about his delivering Ruth's babies. I'm not saying that they had contact, but there's lots of things a man can do to please a woman, even if he can't fuck. Whether or not, the fact is, she was in that bed sucking his fingers. And if she'd do that when he was dead, what'd she do when he was alive? Nothing to do but kill a woman like that. I swear, many's the day I regret she talked me out of killing her. But I wasn't looking forward to spending the rest of my days on some rock pile. But you see, Macon, sometimes I can't catch hold of myself quick enough. It just gets out. Tonight, when she said, "Yes, I am my daddy's daughter," and gave that little smirk, Macon looked up at his son. The door of his face had opened. His skin looked iridescent. With only a minor break in his voice, he told him, "I'm not a bad man. I want you to know that, or believe it. No man ever took his responsibilities more seriously than I have. I'm not making claims to sainthood, but you have to know it all. I'm 40 years older than you, and I don't have another 40 in me. Next time you take it into your head to jump me, I want you to think about the man you think you whip in, and think about the fact that next time I might not let you. Old as I am, I might not let you." He stood up and pushed his handkerchief into his back pocket. "Don't say anything now, but think about everything I've said." Macon turned the doorknob and, without a backward glance, left the room. Milkman sat on the edge of his bed. Everything was still, except for the light buzzing in his head. He felt curiously disassociated from all that he had heard, as though a stranger that he'd sat down next to on a park bench had turned to him and begun to relate some intimacy. He was entirely sympathetic to the stranger's problems, understood perfectly his view of what had happened to him. But part of his sympathy came from the fact that he himself was not involved or in any way threatened by the stranger's story. It was quite the opposite from the feeling he'd had an hour or less ago. The alien who had just walked out of his room was also the man he felt passionately enough about to strike with all the fervor he could summon up. Even now, he could feel the tingle in his shoulder that had signaled the uncontrollable urge to smash his father's face. On the way upstairs to his room, he had felt isolated but righteous. He was a man who saw another man hit a helpless person, and he had interfered. Wasn't that the history of the world? Isn't that what men did? Protected the frail and confronted the king of the mountain. And the fact that the frail was his mother and the king of the mountain his father made it more poignant, but did not change the essential facts. No, he would not pretend that it was love for his mother. She was too insubstantial, too shadowy for love. But it was her vaporishness that made her more needful of defense. She was not a maternal drudge, her mind pressed flat, her shoulders hunched under the burden of housework and care of others, brutalized by a bear of a man. Nor was she the acid-tongued shrew who defended herself with a vicious vocabulary and a fast lip. Ruth was a pale but complicated woman, given to deviousness and ultra-fine manners. She seemed to know a lot and understand very little. It was an interesting train of thought, and new for him. Never had he thought of his mother as a person, a separate individual, with a life apart from allowing or interfering with his own. Milkman put on his jacket and left the house. It was 7:30 in the evening and not yet dark. He wanted to walk and breathe some other air. He wouldn't know what to feel until he knew what to think. And it was difficult thinking in that room where the silver-backed brushes with the MD initials shone in the light, and where the chair his father had just sat in still held the imprint of his buttocks in the cushion. As the stars made themselves visible, Milkman tried to figure what was true and what part of what was true had anything to do with him. What was he supposed to do with this new information his father had dumped on him? Was it an effort to cop a plea? How was he supposed to feel about the two of them now? Was it true, first of all? Had his mother made it with her own father? Macon had said no. That the doctor was impotent. How did he know? Well, he must have known what he was talking about, because he was much too eager for it to be true, to let it go, if there were any possibility it could have taken place. Still, he had admitted there were other things a man could do to please a woman. "God damn," Milkman said aloud. "What the fuck did he tell me all that shit for?" He didn't want to know any of it. There was nothing he could do about it. The doctor was dead. You can't do the past over. Milkman's confusion was rapidly turning to anger. "Strange motherfuckers," he whispered. "Strange. If he wanted me to lay off," he thought, "why didn't he just say that? Just come to me like a man and say, 'Cool it. You cool it, and I'll cool it. We'll both cool it.' And I'd say, 'Okay, you got it.' But no. He comes to me with some way-out tale about how come and why." Milkman was heading toward Southside. Maybe he could find Guitar. A drink with Guitar would be just the thing. Or if he couldn't find Guitar, he'd go see Hager. No, he didn't want to talk to Hager, to any woman, just yet. Talk about strange. Now that was a really strange bunch. His whole family was a bunch of crazies. Pilot, singing all day and talking off the wall. Reba, turning on for everything in pants. And Hager, well, she was just fine, but still, she wasn't regular. She had some queer ways. But at least they were fun and not full of secrets. Where would Guitar be? Never anywhere, when you really needed him. A real pop-up. Popped up anywhere, anytime, but never on time. Milkman realized he was whispering every now and then, and that people on the street were looking at him. Suddenly, it seemed to him that there were a lot of people out for that time of day. Where the hell was everybody going? He made an effort not to vocalize his thoughts. "You want to be a whole man? You have to deal with the whole truth," his father had said. "Couldn't I be a whole man without knowing all that?" "You better have some intelligence behind that fist." "Okay. What intelligence?" "That my mama screwed her daddy? That my grandfather was a high yellow nigger who loved ether and hated black skin? So what did he let you marry his daughter for? So he could screw her without the neighbors knowing it? Did you ever catch them doing it?" "No. You just felt something you couldn't put your finger on. His money, probably. He wouldn't let you put your finger on that, would he? And his daughter wouldn't help you, would she? So you figured they must be getting it on the operating table. If he'd given you those 4 bank books to do what you liked, to buy up the Erie Lackawanna Railroad, he could have had her all he liked, right? He could have come right in your bed, and the 3 of you could have had a ball. He'd get one tit, you'd get the other. Milkman stopped dead in his tracks. Cold sweat broke out on his neck. People jostled him, trying to get past the solitary man standing in their way. He had remembered something, or believed he remembered something. Maybe he dreamed it, and it was the dream he remembered. The picture was developing of the two men in the bed with his mother, each nibbling on a breast. But the picture cracked, and in the crack, another picture emerged. There was this green room, a very small green room, and his mother was sitting in the green room, and her breasts were uncovered, and somebody was sucking them, and the somebody was himself. So what? My mother nursed me. Mothers nurse babies. Why the sweat? He walked on, hardly noticing the people pushing past him, their annoyed, tight faces. He tried to see more of the picture, but couldn't. Then he heard something that he knew was related to the picture. Laughter. Somebody he couldn't see, in the room, laughing, at him, and at his mother. And his mother is ashamed. She lowers her eyes and won't look at him. Look at me, Mama. Look at me. But she doesn't, and the laughter's loud now. Everybody is laughing. Did he wet his pants? Is his mother ashamed because while he was nursing, he wet his pants? What pants? He didn't wear pants then. He wore diapers. Babies always wet their diapers. Why does he think he has pants on? Blue pants with elastic around the calf. Little blue corduroy knickers. Why is he dressed that way? Is that what the man is laughing at? Because he is a tiny baby dressed in blue knickers? He sees himself standing there. Look at me, Mama, is all he can think of to say. Please look at me. Standing. He is a tiny baby, nursing in his mother's arms. He can't stand up. I couldn't stand up, he said aloud, and turned toward a shop window. There was his face, leaning out of the upturned collar of his jacket, and he knew. My mother nursed me when I was old enough to talk, stand up, and wear knickers, and somebody saw it and laughed, and that is why they call me Milkman. And that is why my father never does. And that is why my mother never does, but everybody else does. And how did I forget that? And why? And if she did that to me, when there was no reason for it, when I also drank milk and Ovaltine and everything else from a glass, then maybe she did other things with her father. Milkman closed his eyes and then opened them. The street was even more crowded with people, all going in the direction he was coming from, all walking hurriedly and bumping against him. After a while, he realized that nobody was walking on the other side of the street. There were no cars, and the street lights were on. Now the darkness had come, but the sidewalk on the other side of the street was completely empty. He turned around to see where everybody was going. But there was nothing to see, except their backs and hats pressing forward into the night. He looked again at the other side of Not Doctor Street. Not a soul. He touched the arm of a man in a cap who was trying to get past him. Why is everybody on this side of the street, he asked him. Watch it, buddy, the man snapped and moved on with the crowd. Milkman walked on, still headed toward Southside, never once wondering why he himself did not cross over to the other side of the street, where no one was walking at all. He believed he was thinking coldly, clearly. He had never loved his mother, but had always known that she had loved him, and that had always seemed right to him, the way it should be. Her confirmed, eternal love of him, love that he didn't even have to earn or deserve, seemed to him natural. And now it was decomposing. He wondered if there was anyone in the world who liked him for himself alone. His visits to the wine house seemed, before his talk with his father, an extension of the love he had come to expect from his mother. Not that Pilate or Reba felt the possessive love for him that his mother did, but they had accepted him without question and with all the ease in the world. They took him seriously, too, asked him questions, and thought all his responses to things were important enough to laugh at or quarrel with him about. Everything he did at home was met with quiet understanding from his mother and his sisters, or indifference and criticism from his father. The women in the wine house were indifferent to nothing and understood nothing. Every sentence, every word was new to them, and they listened to what he said like bright-eyed ravens, trembling in their eagerness to catch and interpret every sound in the universe. Now he questioned them, questioned everybody. His father had crept along the wall and then come upstairs with a terrible piece of news. His mother had been portrayed not as a mother who simply adored her only son, but as an obscene child playing dirty games with whatever male was near, be it her father or her son. Even his sisters, the most tolerant and accommodating of all the women he knew, had changed their faces and rimmed their eyes with red and charcoal dust. Where was Guitar? He needed to find the one person left whose clarity never failed him. And unless he was out of the state, Milkman was determined to find him. His first stop, Tommy's barbershop, was fruitful. Guitar was there with several other men, leaning in various attitudes, but all listening to something. As Milkman entered and spotted Guitar's back, he was so relieved, he shouted, "Hey, Guitar!" "Shh," said Railroad Tommy. Guitar turned around and motioned him to come in, but to be quiet. They were listening to the radio and muttering and shaking their heads. It was some time before Milkman discovered what they were so tense about. A young Negro boy had been found stomped to death in Sunflower County, Mississippi. There were no questions about who stomped him. His murderers had boasted freely, and there were no questions about the motive. The boy had whistled at some white woman, refused to deny he had slept with others, and was a northerner visiting the South. His name was Till. Railroad Tommy was trying to keep the noise down so he could hear the last syllable of the newscaster's words. In a few seconds it was over, since the announcer had only a few speculations and even fewer facts. The minute he went on to another topic of news, the barbershop broke into loud conversation. Railroad Tommy, the one who had tried to maintain silence, was himself completely silent now. He moved to his razor strop, while Hospital Tommy tried to keep his customer in the chair. Porter, Guitar, Freddy the janitor, and three or four other men were exploding, shouting angry epithets all over the room. Apart from Milkman, only Railroad Tommy and Empire State were quiet. Railroad Tommy, because he was preoccupied with his razor, and Empire State, because he was simple and probably mute, although nobody seemed sure about that. There was no question whatever about his being simple. Milkman tried to focus on the crisscross conversations. "It'll be in the morning paper." "Maybe it will, maybe it won't," said Porter. "It was on the radio." "Got to be in the paper," said Freddy. "They don't put that kind of news in no white newspaper. Not unless he raped somebody." "What you bet? What you bet it'll be in there?" said Freddy. "Bet anything you can lose," Porter answered. "You on for five." "Wait a minute," Porter shouted. "Say where?" "What you mean, where?" "I got five, says it'll be in the morning paper." "On the sports page?" asked Hospital Tommy. "Or the funny papers," said Nero Brown. "No, man, front page. I bet $5. On front page." "What the fuck is the difference?" shouted Guitar. "A kid is stomped, and you standing round fussing about whether some cracker put it in the paper. He stomped, ain't he? Dead, ain't he? 'Cause he whistled at some Scarlett O'Hara cunt." "What'd he do it for?" asked Freddy. "He knew he was in Mississippi." "What'd he think that was? Tom Sawyerland?" "So he whistled. So what?" Guitar was steaming. "He's supposed to die for that?" "He from the north," said Freddy, "acting big down in Bilbo country. Who the hell he think he is?" "Thought he was a man, that's what," said Railroad Tommy. "Well, he thought wrong," Freddy said. "Ain't no black men in Bilbo country." "The hell they ain't," said Guitar. "Who?" asked Freddy. "Till, that's who." "He dead. A dead man ain't no man. A dead man is a corpse, that's all, a corpse." "A living coward ain't a man either," said Porter. "Who you talking to?" Freddy was quick to get the personal insult. "Calm down, you two," said Hospital Tommy. "You," shouted Porter. "You calling me a coward?" Freddy wanted to get the facts first. "If the shoe fits, put your rusty foot in it." "You all gonna keep that up. You have to get out of my shop. Tell that nigger something," said Porter. "I'm serious now," Hospital Tommy went on. "There is no cause for all this. The boy's dead. His mama's screaming. Won't let them bury him. That ought to be enough colored blood on the streets." "You want to spill blood? Spill the cracker's blood that bashed his face in." "Oh, they'll catch him," said Walters. "Catch him? Catch him?" Porter was astounded. "You out of your fucking mind? They'll catch him all right and give him a big party and a medal." "Yeah, whole town planning a parade," said Nero. "They gotta catch him, so they catch him. You think they'll get any time? Not on your life." "How can they not give him time?" Walter's voice was high and tight. "How?" "Just don't, that's how." Porter fidgeted with his watch chain. "But everybody knows about it now. It's all over, everywhere. The law is the law." "You want to bet? This is sure money." "You stupid man, real stupid. Ain't no law for no colored man, except the one sends him to the chair," said Guitar. "They say Till had a knife," Freddy said. "They always say that. He could have had a wad of bubble gum, and they'd swear it was a hand grenade." "I still say he should have kept his mouth shut," said Freddy. You should keep yours shut, Guitar told him. Hey, man. Again, Freddy felt the threat.